Chapter 17. Britain. The first reports on the morning of the 7th of July 2005 were that a power surge was responsible for the people emerging coughing and blackened from smoke at underground stations in central London. It took only a few minutes to understand this was something far worse. The roof of a bus was ripped off by an explosion in Tavistock Square, the last of four bombs wrecking carnage on the capital's rush hour. At MI5, Eliza Manningham Buller gathered her staff in the atrium of their headquarters and told them their worst fears had been realized. They should brace themselves for questions as to whether they had missed anything, but they also needed to get on with finding out who else was out there. Over at Cheltenham, Ian Lobban returned from London to GCHQ. "I walked back into this building," he later said, "and everyone was looking at me to see was I relaxed or confident, resolute, anxious, nervous, biting my nails, frowning, walking with my head down 100 miles an hour. For the first few days, no one had any idea who had carried this out. The speculation was that a team had come into the country to carry out the attack, and, most likely, they had left their explosives and escaped. But as the police combed through the fragments found at the bomb site, they came across pieces of personal identification and other clues that suggested a different possibility. It emerged that the perpetrators were four Britons willing and able to be suicide bombers in their own country. No one had predicted or prepared for this, including the spies. For all the trauma their American allies had experienced on 9/11, it was only on 7/7 that the reality of what they were facing hit home for Britain's spies. Then, 2 weeks later, it nearly happened again. The failed attack on the 21st of July was, intelligence officials of the time say, almost more terrifying than the successful ones 2 weeks earlier. Suddenly they were faced with the possibility of wave after wave coming at them. There was also the problem that the 21st of July bombers had escaped after their bombs fizzled and failed to detonate. The fear was they would strike again. A manhunt ensued. In its initial stages, it went terribly wrong when an innocent Brazilian was shot dead on the tube by police who believed he was one of the bombers. But after that, technology played a key role. Crises often lead to new capabilities being deployed. The police and MI5 needed to find the suspects, but they had abandoned their existing mobile phones and practiced good operational security in their communications. The authorities believed, though, that they might be in touch with each other or other contacts. So how could they find them? The answer lay in contact chaining phone records, the technique the US had begun using after 9/11 with its bulk collection program. This required access to records of UK phone calls on a large scale. The 1984 Telecoms Act likely provided the legal authority. Officials will not comment, but this is believed to be the first time such bulk analysis was used. Investigators began hunting for possible contacts. This led directly to working out what phones the men were now using within 24 hours. Two of the men were tracked to a flat in West London where they were arrested on the 29th of July. Another was arrested in Italy. The attacks had hit home in a different way from the US. In America on 9/11, the hijackers were foreign, mainly from Saudi Arabia. Some of them were known to US intelligence, and they had travelled into the country to carry out the attack. That led to the conclusion that what was needed was to join the dots between domestic and foreign intelligence. In Britain on 7/7, the men were, to use the unpleasant jargon, homegrown, although they had travelled abroad for training. They were not quite what were known as clean skins, since two of them had been on the periphery of another counter-terrorist investigation the previous year, but no one had spotted how dangerous they were. So while the first question was the same as in the US, how many more plots and attackers, the answer to the second question, how do we find them, was different. This was a problem of finding people within your own community rather than people who had come into your country from outside. The twin attacks had led to a question. How did you find Britons willing to carry out such acts? To answer the question, a new, powerful and secret capability employing data, telecoms and computing would be built at GCHQ in the coming years. It was classified to the highest level, with only named individuals knowing its full extent and authorized by the Prime Minister. One of the revelations that surprised British investigators who looked into the background of the four suicide bombers was how much of their lives had been lived online. In the confines of the Donut at Cheltenham, GCHQ staff realized that theirs was an organization that understood the bits and bytes of technology and the internet, but not necessarily how the world outside, and especially a younger generation, actually used it all. How they messaged each other, how they visited websites and used social media, how they planned and organized their lives. The irony is that for a technological organization, GCHQ was pretty bad at understanding the way the internet and technology were integrating into people's lives and transforming them. That was because no one was allowed internet access at work, or even to bring in a mobile phone. One veteran describes jumping the first time his mobile phone rang after he left government service, as he had never heard it make that sound before. To find their new targets, the experts believed they needed to understand the way they lived their lives and find patterns and connections. Two of the bombers might have been to Pakistan, where they were trained and tasked, but how had they got there? It looked as if the initial radicalization and recruitment that drew them over there had taken place on the internet. So to find people like them, you needed to look online. What you wanted was a system that allowed you to investigate the richness of the trail people left in their digital lives, even perhaps to build a pattern of terrorist behavior, and then to ask a computer who else matched it. Could you take a huge pile of data and ask it, who was communicating between Britain and Pakistan? That sift would take you down from the whole population to still potentially tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of people, but then ask, who of these people has also visited certain extremist websites? Now you were down to perhaps a few hundred. And who of those had social connections to known extremists? Perhaps now you are down to a handful. This could all be done by looking not at the content of their communications, but types of metadata. Having narrowed the list down to a few, the names of any people in the UK on that list could then be handed over to MI5 for investigation and correlation with their existing files. GCHQ remains foreign-facing, while MI5 leads on investigations at home, and would go to a government minister and ask for a warrant to intercept the actual content of those people's communications to establish if indeed they were involved in terrorism. Stovepipes were broken down between the three British intelligence agencies, GCHQ, MI5 and MI6, so that small joint teams would work together on terrorist targets and share leads. In the past, GCHQ was highly protective of its intelligence, fearing its use by the others could compromise the source. MI5 staff used to call the GCHQ officer dealing with their requests Dr. No because of his predictable response to any request. But that changed, although GCHQ's role was often hidden. Quite often, other people get credit for our work, and we smile wryly and get on with it, Ian Lobban said in a 2010 interview. Whether it be a very clever sniffer dog or a sister agency or an overseas intelligence agency, you just smile and think that's the price for staying in business sometimes. Intelligence officials are adamant that what they built worked and point to the fact that in the nearly 10 years from 7/7 to the start of 2015, only one person was killed by terrorism in the UK. Lee Rigby in Woolwich in 2013. The point of computers, as in the past, was not to replace people, but to be able to reduce the workload so that it becomes manageable for a finite number of people to focus their time on the priorities. Because I have a certain number of analysts, the more I can throw away, the better, Lobban argued in 2010. Computing power made this possible to a new degree. GCHQ remained foreign-focused, but, like the NSA, was drawn into the connections between British and overseas. After 7/7, specifically, people who had trained or been in touch with Al-Qaeda in Pakistan. A decade later, it would be the same for Syria. During the war, Bletchley Park used data and decryption to find German submarines cruising the Atlantic looking for their prey. Now it was using data and decryption to hunt for terrorists hiding in the online space that everybody inhabited. And to perform this kind of data analysis, you need data, and not just some of the data. The point was that if you want to do it effectively, you need as much data as possible. The analogy of finding a needle in a haystack is sometimes used to explain the idea of finding a terrorist hiding in the population at large, but in some ways this does not explain how data sifts work. If you were really looking for a needle in a haystack, then you would want as small a haystack as possible to increase your chances of spotting the needle. But in data mining, to discover unknown targets, you want to have as much hay as possible. Firstly, to be sure that your target is in there and not in another data set, and secondly, to make it easier to do the kind of pattern analysis that helps you understand what normal looks like and what makes a terrorist look different to everyone else, even when they are trying their best to blend in. The problem comes when, to totally overextend the analogy, a needle is doing its best to look like hay, and so you need to know how needles behave as opposed to hay, so that you can get better at spotting them over time. The building of this capability relied on a number of key developments. One was the legal authorization to undertake this kind of work and get hold of the data. Spies in the UK and the US have been careful to get legal cover for their work, but the histories and frameworks of the two allies are different. In 1763, an angry King George III issued a general warrant. Its aim was to find the authors, printers, and publishers, and anyone else involved in publishing a damning critique of the King's speech opening Parliament. Searches led to 49 people being arrested, including John Wilkes, the radical author of the critique. The case proved controversial because, rather than issue a warrant to search for a specific person, a blanket warrant had been used to find persons unknown. In modern parlance, this was the difference between targeted surveillance involving intrusion against a known suspect and a broader trawl of everyone. The controversy was most keenly felt in the British colony of America. Similar general warrants were used to trawl houses and premises for goods on which tax had not been paid to the Crown. After the Revolution, this led directly to the Fourth Amendment to the Constitution that prohibited the new state from unreasonable searches and seizures without probable cause. Constitutionless Britain never saw quite such a restriction on general warrants, and they continued to be employed, sometimes with mixed results. In the mid-1840s, a secret parliamentary committee found that 6 or 7 individual warrants were in force to open people's mail, but on average 2 general warrants a year were being issued. General warrants formed the basis for the First World War intercept system in the hunt for German spies. These covered categories of communication, sometimes as broad as anything suspected to contain matter of a dangerous tendency. At times, this could mean any letter addressed to France, Flanders, or Holland, or even an envelope suspected to contain such a letter. General warrants tended to be used to comb through communications to try to find people who might be German spies. Individual warrants were used against those already suspected. In the era of pervasive computing and data mining, these distinctions could also be applied to finding terrorist suspects. General warrants would allow bulk access to data travelling along the global cable system, and a clause of the 1984 Telecoms Act would allow a minister to demand a network provider carry out any act deemed necessary for national security and keep it secret. Forms of bulk access have actually taken place in the past. For instance, the blanket collection of calls between the UK and Ireland in the search for intelligence on the IRA during the Troubles in Northern Ireland. When briefed about it at the time, one American told a British colleague the NSA would never have been able to do that. But this had never been done on so large a scale, and never combined with the kind of computer analytics that became possible after 7/7. The other development was technology. It was only in the year or so before 7/7 that systems first became available to carry out the kind of data mining and analysis that was wanted. The initial work to master rather than be defeated by the Internet had started in the late 1990s under a program called SINUS. It involved mapping the path of data around the world and using advanced algorithms to work out how then to piece together individual packets so you could reconstruct a message. Those involved say that this involved a Bletchley level of ingenuity over many years. Around the time of 7/7, GCHQ then undertook a huge modernization process known as SIGMOD. This took up a significant proportion of the entire UK intelligence budget. The results were staggering. Over 2 years from 2005, it delivered a 20-fold increase in GCHQ's ability to access, process, and store particular types of communications. This involved returning to the First World War business of cable tapping. But this time it meant plugging into those fibre-optic cables that landed in places like Cornwall, carrying international data. A splitter could now be attached to a fibre-optic cable to divert the light into a box, and a probe or bearer could then take it onwards, as found in the American junction points. Unlike satellite communications, where you could just put up your own dish to pull down the signals, with cables you needed physical access. As in the past, this was done with the cooperation of telecoms companies with obligations under law, although willingness to work with the system may still vary from company to company. This provided a fire hose of data to work on. It particularly focused on Middle East, North African, and European data, because this is where the data transiting Britain through cables was heading. The take of the intelligence systems was staggering. One leaked presentation from August 2012 said that over the previous 5 years, GCHQ access to light, meaning the fibre-optic traffic, increased 7,000%, and the amount analysed and processed by 3,000%. One document talked of receiving upwards of 50 billion events, the many different outward details of a phone call or email being sent, per day, and noted this was growing. The legacy of Britain's Imperial Telegraph system meant a significant part of the world's cable traffic still flowed underneath those Cornish beaches. How much? A lot passes by the sensors, but certainly not everything. Even against critical targets, the coverage of their communications is normally only partial. Tempora, GCHQ's filtering system, does not have access to all traffic. At one point it had access to around 200 internet links, but only the capacity to analyse 46 at a time. And the system is only able to process a portion of that. But it appears that the UK may still have access to a far greater amount of traffic from cables than the US, thanks to geography, although the US has the advantage when it comes to data held by its companies. The size of global data flows still poses a problem as well as an opportunity for spy agencies. It is the equivalent of placing a fire hose to your mouth and trying to take a drink. The volume is enormous. If you are after something specific, as opposed to broad data mining, how do you find what you want in that torrent? The trick is to filter. Some of this can be done automatically, getting rid of all the video and music being streamed and downloaded. That still leaves a lot. But then you set up filters to reduce it down further and further to the point where it is manageable. Spies say their aim is to throw away as much as possible and claim this is no different from the days of Bletchley, when people out in stations around the world would listen in to huge amounts of radio, most of it innocent, to find the German signal, which could then be sent back to Bletchley for decryption. The difference is that now this can be done with smart programming through computers. We access the internet at scale so as to dissect it with surgical precision, Ian Lobban would argue. Practically, it is now impossible to operate successfully in any other way. You can't pick and choose the components of a global interception system that you like, catching terrorists and paedophiles, and those you don't, incidental collection of data at scale. It's one integrated system. Tempora slows down the fire hose of global data flows by buffering some of it. The content is reported to be kept for 3 days and the metadata for 30 days, which gives analysts time to search through it. This is done by using selectors, say an email address or a phone number, which can be searched for within the buffer of data so that the relevant messages are then kept. Tempora is said to provide 10 times more information than the next largest database, according to leaked documents. A portion of traffic can also be searched through with bespoke queries based on 3 or 4 terms. Show me anyone in Russia communicating with Iran using encryption. Or find anyone using a particular type of encryption and who is also searching for information about bombs or visiting extremist websites. According to reports, GCHQ was running about 40,000 selectors and the NSA 31,000 across one dataset. The black box might be in Cornwall, but these can be added remotely by an intelligence analyst sitting at his or her desk hundreds or even thousands of miles away. A search needs to be proportionate, pull up too many results, and it cannot be justified. As well as legal limits, there is also the simple restraint of manpower to work through the results. In a world of bulk intercept and computing power, the need for human eyeballs and ears has become one of the key constraints and restraints on spying. Millions of communications pass by GCHQ sensors and through its systems each day, but only a few thousand are examined by analysts who are presented with an index, like the results of a web page, from which they pick the items that appear relevant. These can then be read or stored. Modern communications intelligence systems do not always rely on reading the content of someone's phone call or email, but often on analyzing the metadata, defined sometimes as the information generated as people use technology, formerly called communications data in the UK. In communications, this would be the fact of a message going from one person to another, and when, but not what, was written or said. When it comes to bulk access as opposed to targeted intelligence, collecting metadata can be more useful than content. This is partly because it is much easier to store than content due to its size, but primarily because of its relatively defined or structured nature. It is what is known as machine-readable. In other words, machines can process it with their algorithms. If someone presents you with a whole stream of content data, it will have all kinds of things mixed up together, video and music on different formats, for instance. Some of it might be encrypted. Also, the language, even in written content, may include slang, nuance, and code words, which computers struggle to understand. But metadata is much cleaner and simpler, and therefore much easier for a computer to sort through and analyze. Increasingly, even though it is not as revealing as content, metadata itself is rich enough to answer many queries. Listening to phone calls requires real people and takes up a lot of their time. Analyzing metadata to look for connections takes a computer a moment. The controls covering metadata are also lighter. A general warrant allows bulk collection of traffic moving internationally, which can then be sifted, a process often known as trawling, the equivalent of a fisherman sweeping up everything in his vast net. Some domestic traffic may well be swept up since so much of the data goes abroad, for instance, to a Google server for a web search. This then becomes available for metadata analysis. However, the next stage of actually reading the content of someone in the UK's communications still requires an individual warrant or similar authorization personally signed by a minister. The lighter controls on metadata reflected the era in which noting down whom a letter was being sent to was seen as far less intrusive than opening it and reading the content. But modern metadata can be much more revealing about a person, since people communicate much more and leave more of a digital trail in their lives, which can be reconstructed using metadata alone. Everyone recognized this was a hugely powerful capability. Senior officials decided to limit how they would use this powerful new tool, resolving initially only to use it for terrorist-related searches, although the same global collection system is also used to search for traces of cyber espionage. Analysts who accessed the database were given instructions on how to use it. Any misuse might be initially punished with a serious warning and a fine. A second misuse would lead to an analyst being marched out of the door. Any search leaves an audit trail that can then be examined as part of the oversight process, including by an independent commissioner, normally a judge. Targeted surveillance, following someone you know, was now joined in the computer age by target discovery, finding a target you do not know but believe is out there. Terrorists do not always fit a profile and seek ways deliberately to ensure they do not. So there is a technological cat-and-mouse game to try to find those in hiding amid all the noise. The desire for target discovery has driven this system. The fear of the unknown in the era of international terrorism and the desire to find terrorists before they do something. And those targets have become harder to find, spies claim. For instance, a large group of plotters planning something ambitious like 9/11 offer many opportunities when they talk to someone already being investigated or do something suspicious. But so-called lone wolves radicalizing themselves online leave few traces, except perhaps in their online activity. The politics surrounding terrorism means the pressure on the state and intelligence agencies to prevent attacks is enormous, and the consequences of failure high, but the complicated issue is how far to go in trying to reduce risk. That is a profoundly political question, complicated by the fact that the capabilities involved have often been kept secret for fear of compromising their value by exposing them. Some officials say that the new capabilities are valuable as part of a toolkit rather than as a silver bullet to replace other traditional techniques like running agents and human or individual technical surveillance. They say that they have been most useful for establishing connections and unraveling a network once you had already identified someone rather than finding complete unknowns. Digital intelligence, they say, can be used to narrow a large group down to those you really should be focusing on, so that in turn you can target finite resources on them and not others. The problem on 7/7 was, after all, not that the men were truly clean skins, but that two of them had not been sufficiently highly prioritized for further investigation after a previous plot and their changes in behavior over time had not been understood. Prioritization is vital, since MI5 has only a limited number of surveillance and investigative teams to deploy. "We are not the Stasi, we can't cover everyone," one British intelligence official said in the wake of 7/7 to explain what had happened. The rich trail of data and communications, and the power of computers, was changing spying again. As well as a new way of finding targets, it offered new ways of following those who had already been identified. In the past, targeted surveillance was labor-intensive. Following someone home or listening to their phone calls was possible, but took a large team. Now, with a click of a mouse, an analyst can carry out a form of electronic surveillance in an instant, capturing the data surrounding someone's life. If they are British, they still require a ministerial warrant, but if they are foreign, just the tick of a box on a computer screen to justify the need from a pull-down menu of options relating to the Human Rights Act. The vast data trail of modern life, the digital exhaust that we all leave as we move around online, can then be accessed. The state is also able to acquire what are called bulk data sets to use in its analysis. This could be a list of everyone who has a firearms or pilot's license, for instance, but could potentially be much broader as well, since some of the data sets are said to cover millions of people. These can be acquired through overt means, a demand to a company or public body, or covertly, effectively stealing them, especially if they are located abroad. And they could be acquired and retained with relatively little authorization and, until revealed in 2015, no real oversight. A person's digital exhaust is almost unique, meaning they can be identified unless they are very skilled at hiding. Mobile phones, which are more tied to a person than a PC, have aided that process enormously. These are usually tied to an individual in a way a computer, which can be shared in an office or internet cafe, is not. In the past, putting a tracking device or a bug in a car or a house was a risky task. Now, people carry just such a multi-purpose device around themselves that can provide many more details than just their location or what they are saying. Using tools, analysts can build up a digital fingerprint of a target based on how they move online and what devices and identities they use. In turn, this can be used to track them in real time, much as a surveillance team would follow them around in the real world, just with a lot less people and a lot more computing. In the past, it would take dozens of people to follow one suspect around all the time. Now, electronic coverage can provide something close at a fraction of the cost. Again, computing has lowered the practical cost of surveillance. This is just one of the ways it has transformed spying. In the late 1990s, an old hand cryptologist made the 35-mile drive from the NSA to go to work at Langley for the CIA. He found a different culture. He noted that NSA staff liked to think their work was cleaner compared to the moral ambiguity of the CIA's efforts, which involved manipulating or blackmailing people to betray their own countries and break their own laws. The intercept floor resembles a laboratory or high-tech clean room with lots of gizmos and people in clean military uniforms listening intently to radios. It is far from a back alley in a dirty foreign capital that reeks of discarded vegetable peelings, he wrote. It meant sitting in a station bristling with antennae and never meeting your target face to face, just perhaps listening to them. On occasions when I have questioned NSA audiences, most refuse to believe they are engaged in spying. But that officer noted that the days of splendid isolation for the two sides were passing. They were going to have to work together. Moral ambiguity, meet Mr. Clean, meet your savior, he told the CIA. Computers and data have changed the dynamic between GCHQ and MI6, and between communications and human intelligence as a whole. The techniques of target discovery and digital intelligence can now be used to support what might be thought of as old-fashioned human intelligence. There was a point, former British spies say, when MI6 looked lost and a little vulnerable in the new digital world and feared it might be washed up. In the old days, if a document had been sought, then they would have been the ones tasked with getting hold of it, recruiting a spy in the form of a diplomat or a clerk, perhaps in the foreign ministry of the target country. But from the 1990s onwards, GCHQ was often able to deliver the document far more easily, and perhaps even offer previous drafts of the document as well while they were at it. What makes cyber espionage so powerful was the ability to extract information on a totally different scale to old-fashioned espionage, and with a lower level of risk. Spies like Kim Philby and Oleg Gordievsky had to risk their lives to carry out secret documents and hand them over to their controllers at clandestine meetings, now someone can sit in London or Moscow and download thousands of pages of material in a few moments with little risk, although the most sensitive material that Philby or Gordievsky had access to is unlikely to be online. The saving grace for the old human spies was that access to the hardest targets still often required a human agent. Sometimes it was because you needed a human agent to enable the act of cyber espionage to steal a document. Perhaps a person was needed to get into the foreign ministry to plug in a USB stick and gain access to the classified network that was air-gapped from the internet. In these cases, MI6 might become the enabler of GCHQ's cyber espionage operations by providing the human access point into a network. Sometimes people were needed, though, because only a human being and not a computer held the answers you were after. This can apply even to technical tasks like finding out who was behind a cyber attack on your country that had been routed around the internet to cover its tracks. A spy inside the PLA might still tell you who was behind it. A human spy may also provide the first lead, which is then acted on with the communications capabilities, providing a suspicious name or number or perhaps a profile of someone that can be fed through the databases and systems. Computers and data increasingly helped MI6 find its targets. GCHQ in the past was often the enabler for human intelligence operations by, for example, providing intercepts of the phone calls of someone that MI6 might be trying to recruit so they could learn about them and perhaps their foibles. Now computers might provide a richer trail of data to identify those worth approaching so you can work out how to persuade or pressure them to spy. This can even be automated to some extent. MI6 might want to get into the Iranian nuclear program and so may use computer databases to ask who has access to the program through contractor companies, what their links are to the outside world, including any to the UK, whom they know on social networks, and how they might be contacted. Having run that through global data mining, a small group of people might be found who fit the profile. Alerts could be then set so that if any of those potential targets are travelling out of the country or checking into a hotel room, then the human spy service can be informed immediately and can be waiting at the hotel in order to approach them. In this way, computers have allowed human espionage to become more targeted. In March 2015, the director of the CIA announced a major shake-up of the agency that involved integrating cyber and digital intelligence much more closely with traditional human intelligence operations. Our online and offline worlds are merging to the point where distinctions will become increasingly meaningless, including in spying. Computers were changing intelligence by making it harder to hide. Osama bin Laden managed it for years, but only by never connecting to the internet and using human couriers physically carrying USB sticks. Computers and digital surveillance can help spies find their targets, but of course the converse is also true. It makes it easier for other countries to find your spies. In October 2011, German police commandos burst into a family home in Marburg. They found a Russian deep cover spy, known as an illegal, communicating with Moscow. The woman promptly fell off her chair in shock. What was so telling was that her computer was receiving encoded data over a shortwave radio frequency rather than through the internet. In other words, the Russians knew that connecting up to the internet might give them away. The Russians were also reported to be returning to typewriters in their embassies. Old-fashioned techniques like secret ink are making a return, and British spies talk of having to go medieval to hide. This was a sign of how the techniques of data mining and bulk intercept can be used against spies and not just by them. Spy services are all too aware that data can be used for counterintelligence. Italian investigators found CIA officers involved in a rendition operation in 2003 by combing the trails of things like phone records and hotel bookings they had left in Milan in order to identify who had been involved. Dubai police surprised many spy agencies by using similar techniques and CCTV to find a Mossad hit team which killed a Hamas operative in a hotel room. Open source, publicly available data was also used to track the movements of CIA planes involved in rendition operations. Other countries will be able to spot a British MI6 officer working undercover much more easily now by looking at the plausibility of the digital trail he or she leaves behind. A faked birth certificate or passport might have been enough in the old days to build a backstory, a legend in the parlance of John le Carré and the Cold War, and an officer could travel into a country on one passport and then assume three different identities in one day to meet three different agents. But now he or she might have to get through biometrics and database checks to enter a country, and their fake identity will need to have a presence online with its own history. Without that, judicious use of a search engine can be enough to show that someone is not who they say they are, or that, suspiciously, they only appeared online recently. Spies used to be paranoid about their personal details emerging in public, but now the very fact that you have no personal data trail may well mark you out as a spy. When MI6 ran a test to see how long an officer's cover could stand up against Google and a suspicious foreign state, the answer was about a minute. Using more advanced data mining, spy hunters will be able to find unknowns by looking for behavior among the masses that exhibits the typical signature characteristics of an undercover operative. Real spies have always sought not to stand out, like James Bond, but to blend in and be the grey man. That will require a different skill set in the future. Spying has been enabled, but also challenged by computers. A digital data trail works both ways. Tradecraft online is as important as offline. Spy services in the future will rise and fall, succeed and fail, based on their ability to master these techniques to find their opponents and hide themselves in the digital world. So, what of the special relationship founded at Bletchley after the journey over the Atlantic? Britain was the senior partner during that war, but the scale of American resources, expressed in money, people, and computing power, was confirmed from the start of the Cold War and persists beyond it. The U.S. intelligence budget in 2012 was $54 billion. That of the U.K. was about $3 billion. They are obviously much bigger than us, Ian Lobban said of the NSA in a 2010 interview, in terms of money, in terms of numbers of people. They rate our geography, our people, our expertise, our analytic contribution. And we are not an uncritical partner, as they are not an uncritical partner. If we think they have got something wrong, we will say so. He argued that the relationship was based on sharing where it was possible to do so, but with limits based on international law. Are they equal partners? I think we hold our end up, he replied. In the high-end maths of cryptanalysis that Turing once pioneered, the relationship is still close, but always with an edge of insecurity in Britain, knowing that it has more to lose by the relationship weakening. The geography of empire and its legacy used to provide Britain with something to take to the party. Hong Kong, for example, had been of strategic importance for the interception of communications until it was handed over in 1997, and the overall importance of other foreign satellite and radio intercept stations diminished. In the early 1990s, much of the intelligence that came out of GCHQ actually came from the US. But then the fiber-optic cables began to be laid, and here Britain continued to have unique access thanks to the global web that still followed many of the paths of the old imperial system. This is one reason why a British base at Bude in Cornwall was modernized, in part with millions of pounds of American funding. Thanks both to the history and geography of the cable system, as well as its different regulatory environment, Britain had access to more global traffic than the US. We are in the Golden Age, one person from GCHQ noted. The Five Eyes Alliance has deepened, dividing up the world for coverage. In the Cold War, this might have been in order to look for the signals of Soviet submarines. Today it is for data. Yuku Tsar made it clear there would be a presumption to share, but some categories of information could be withheld. This included intelligence Britain was collecting on Ireland and Northern Ireland during its struggle with the IRA. Officials maintain that members of the Five Eyes Club do not spy on each other as a matter of course, although there are provisions to do so if deemed necessary for a country's own security, and are not allowed to evade their own country's restrictions by asking another to do something it is not supposed to do. Leaked draft documents do indicate, though, that the countries retain the right to break the agreement in circumstances where they feel it necessary. A leaked diplomatic cable suggests that UK intentions and activities at the United Nations with regard to International Atomic Energy Agency, IAEA, policy towards Iran were on a human intelligence collective directive. There are still cultural differences. A former Western intelligence official described what he calls a typical Five Eyes meeting. The Americans look a bit bored, the British try and sound attentive, the Aussies get drunk, the Canadians are normally reeling from the latest scandal, and the New Zealanders are desperately scribbling notes. However, that person remembered that everything stopped when General Keith Alexander from the NSA talked. Everyone paid attention then. When he became head of the NSA in 2005, General Alexander, a hard-charging army man, was already deeply versed in technology and what it could do, but he would become a hugely powerful advocate for bulk collection and analysis. A brutal insurgency was growing in Iraq as he took the helm. American casualty figures were spiraling as soldiers were being killed or having their limbs blown off by improvised explosive devices that seemed to be everywhere. The traditional role of the NSA in supporting combat forces came under pressure, with commanders saying intelligence was too slow in reaching the people who needed it. Alexander responded with a new program which sucked up all the communications metadata flowing through Iraq. This might allow you to find an individual target, but it also allowed you to do a lot more. Rather than look for a single needle in the haystack, his approach was, "Let's collect the whole haystack," a former senior U.S. intelligence official told the Washington Post. "Collect it all, tag it, store it, and whatever it is you want, you go searching for it." This allowed you to perform pattern analysis across the data. The NSA developed techniques for analyzing all cell phones that fitted the particular profile or signature of a phone typically used to detonate improvised explosive devices. The location of these phones could then be plugged back into the bulk analysis system to show where the bombs might be. The analysts next realized that if they found a cluster of phones all showing the same characteristics, then they may have found a bomb factory. This type of intelligence was pushed down much faster to military teams on the ground, so they could avoid bombs and take out the factories, reducing the death toll. "We successfully reduced that disconnect from 16 hours to around 1 minute," Alexander later said. NSA computer hackers were also employed to get inside insurgent computer networks to disrupt their plans and deceive them, even to try to work out where videos of attacks might have been uploaded from, using new forensic tools to try to overcome the attribution and anonymity problems associated with the Internet. The NSA's support extended to the most controversial tactic of counterterrorism, drone attacks. "We track 'em, you whack 'em," was the motto adopted by one NSA unit to describe its role. GCHQ also began to adapt to supporting the military, particularly in Helmand, Afghanistan, deploying its staff to work close to the front lines where they could supply tactical communications intelligence as fast as possible. For the NSA, the drive was to apply the same techniques more broadly, getting it all, so you could see what you could do, in terms of bulk collection and analysis. Alexander, in particular, was said to be a man who liked to push to do more. The Cold War traffic analysis was designed to prevent the surprise of a nuclear attack. But counter-terrorist analysis is much harder. You are looking not for a signal sent from a known commander to missile silos telling them to launch. You are looking for perhaps an email from an Al-Qaeda commander in Yemen telling someone in East London in guarded language to move ahead. Or perhaps a man in New York downloading bomb-making instructions and posting his intent on a closed web forum. Terrorists are more adaptive than the old Soviet military as they seek to hide. What this means is that the kind of assurance that Cold War signals intelligence provided, and for which a huge enterprise was built, is not easily replicable in looking for the modern terrorist equivalent of a launch signal. And even just trying to replicate that level of assurance requires gathering many more signals, which are now blended with those of ordinary people in the vast tide of the Internet, including those of your own population. That has implications which societies desperate to stop terrorism are only just thinking about. Avoiding another 9/11 or another 7/7 was an imperative for spies and their political leaders. This meant that powerful capabilities were built up and in secret. These were built with the agreement and sometimes at the instigation of political leaders and stemmed from a desire for a zero-risk approach to terrorism. Was it too much? Over the years, one or two on the inside dissented about what was being done by the spies. A GCHQ analyst called Catherine Gunn leaked details of a spying surge on the UN as part of the drive to war in Iraq in 2003. There were not many out of the thousands who inhabited the secret world, but one individual would grow to loathe the system, especially the one built by Alexander in America, and would try to bring it down. For GCHQ, the legacy of Bletchley was utter secrecy. Even so much as a whisper risked compromising capability by letting the other side know what you could and could not do. That secrecy was about to be blown apart.